This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. Got some things accomplished. Visited with some friends. It's been a good week. So, anyways, this is episode 733. On our way to 2000. So I'm officially now in the first sprint for book 19. And that seems to be going fine. I don't quite know where we're going yet. I was talking to a friend this morning at breakfast, and we were talking about the writing process and how that works out for me and all that kind of stuff. And I was telling him about book 17, where all I had was a setting and I knew what one of my main characters was doing, but I didn't know why. And he was saying, man, you see, I find that fascinating that you didn't know. I said, no, I didn't know. And I couldn't figure, I was writing it and I was like, what is going on? But I said, you know, at that point, I had done 16 books already and I'd learned to just trust the process. And it took me 4 chapters to figure out why this character was where he was and why he was doing what he was doing and to figure out exactly what he was doing. And I told him, I said, that's a little spooky because, you know, by the time you're in 4 chapters, you're somewhere around 20, 30,000 words already, and that's unrecoverable if you have to throw that away because the writing schedule is so tight that if I lose a couple of weeks, it's really hard to get back on track. So I have to crank out 10,000 words a week approximately, or just maintain a reasonable gap in order to get these books done. And I told him, you know, so there's no, it has to go down close the first time. I've had situations where I've had to back up and kind of move some things around and redivide the chapters, and that can be done, but it's a little rough, but it can be done. So I don't like to get into situations where I have to do that, but it's just amazing. And part of that conversation was talking about how if an individual says, well, God has never spoken to me, or says, well, I don't believe that God speaks to people any longer. Part of that conversation was, okay, so what do you say to that? And what about people that just say, you know, God never speaks to me? And my response to him, and we talked about it for quite a while, was that first of all, the experiences that I relate in my life, where I believe it is God speaking to me, come about having spent a vast majority of my life listening for God. Because my mom was training me from a very early age, have you asked Jesus to help you? And so by the time I hit puberty, you know, whenever, 11, 12, sometime in there, I've already had almost a decade of training, of practice. And I was telling my buddy, and I think I've mentioned it somewhere in the podcast before, I was getting, it was somewhere in that time frame, maybe a little earlier, maybe a little later, where we were getting ready to make another transition. So I can't remember whether it was coming home from the field or getting ready to go back to the field in the Philippines. This would have been in the Philippines. And I was upset because I was feeling myself getting all torn up and my friends getting all torn up because, you know, you go overseas, you make friends, and then you have to leave. And then you come back to the States and you make friends while you itinerate, and then you have to leave. And you, and it's always tearing up and tearing up. And I was growing weary of that as a missionary kid. And I was complaining. And it was somewhere around, it would have probably been, it was either 10 or 12, one of those two. I think it was 10. And I was complaining because, you know, I don't like living like this. And look, all my friends, you know, they're sad. And, you know, I'm leaving and blah, 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 blah. And in the midst of all of that, feeling sorry for myself, and I don't understand why I have to tear everything up, you know, every couple of years. And I felt like God spoke to me and said, the reason everything is getting torn up is because you are planting roots, not seeds. And I was talking to my friend about the fact that that's a pretty deep concept for a 10-year-old. The idea that as you are participating with people, you can have a relation such that what you're trying to do is push down into them and draw strength from them like roots do, draw nourishment from them. That's one type of relationship that you can have. Or you can have another type of a relationship where instead of roots, you're planting seeds in their heart, such that after you've left, those seeds can sprout and produce something beautiful that can then sustain them. And my friend nodded. He said, yeah, that's a pretty advanced concept for, you know, a 10-year-old. But that thought came to me, I believe, as a direct result of the fact that my mom had trained me for years and years and years to be ready to hear his voice. And so he was able to communicate with me, and just that phrase, that's because you're planting roots, not seeds, was all I needed to, at that young age, radically change my approach to my relationships with others. Those few words was all I needed. And I've found that God has that capability, that when he speaks to us, he can speak in such a way that he can shudder us right down to our foundations. So it's fascinating stuff. And I mean, I just had a situation where I had gone to the restroom and I had taken my coffee cup and stuck it way over in the corner on the lavatory sinks, and then had gone to the restroom and then walked out of the restroom without my Contigo coffee mug, which I have three, which I bring to work because I take 2 16-ounce of coffee with me, and then black, and then one green tea with me. That's what I bring into work every day because I don't eat at work. I had left one, so I don't like leaving my Contigo mugs around. And I thought, oh, as I was packing up my stuff, oh, I've left that in the bathroom. Oh, I need to go get that. And then, of course, I just went into automatic mode where you're just walking down the stairs and you're heading out towards the car. And I just made it out through the exit door to go outside. And Jesus was like, you forgot your Contigo mug. And I was like, oh. And spun around, went back in. But I was also telling my friend this morning that I had another one of those little experiences where last Saturday, I record my videos for the costumes on Saturday. Well, last Saturday, it was the first big week of the writing sprint, and I was behind. Technically not behind, but, you know, that it was Easter, and so I'd lost time, you know, and I was trying to get all that stuff put together, and I had made it through the first week of the writing sprint, but, you know, you have some hints and helps that week, because you start off with like 7,000 words and you only have to get to 10,000 by the end of the week. So that was last week, and then, you know, then we had Easter, and then this was this week. Well, with Easter and everything, it threw off the schedule, and so I got started late, and I was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But even last Saturday, I was a little behind, and I was trying to get caught up, and had books to pack up for beta and blah, 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 blah. And so I had gotten home on Saturday, and I was bustling around, got my video recorded, got everything put away so I could get down and start writing. And then something else was going on Saturday that slowed me down as well. I can't remember. Then I think it was in the evening, Saturday evening, I went out to put something in my car and I couldn't find my car keys. And I was looking and looking and looking, and there were no car keys. And I was like, you know, so I was looking and looking. And I couldn't find him, and I was praying, you know, dear Jesus, what in the world did I do with my car keys? And it's always interesting, because we had an old hanger by the door that goes out to the garage. There was a thing that we hung our keys on there, and that, for the last 30 years, and it has been 30 years because we moved into that house in 1993, so basically for the last 3 decades, my ritual is I have my car keys in my hand most of the time. When I walk into the house, I take my car keys and hang them on that keyboard, car hanger thingy. Key hanger, and then I know where they are, and it's just automatic, you know, because I've done it so many times. It's just like tink, now I know where they are. Well, my beloved wanted to make a new one to make it cooler, and she did. It was cool by the time she got finished, but it was off the wall for days while she worked on that project. And so instead of hanging my keys up, I had my keys in my hand, and then I recorded a video, and then something. And I wasn't sure what that something was. Something. Well, you know, my flesh is going, well, if there was a keyboard up there, and you could have hung your keys, and you wouldn't be looking for your keys. That was just enough to cause enough noise in my system. I wasn't really getting an answer very quickly, but I was just like, nope, 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 it's not your wife's fault. You were the one who lost track of your keys. And, you know, I was looking and looking, couldn't find them, couldn't find them, couldn't find them. And then I was downstairs looking, and there was, you know, nothing. And then suddenly an image flashed through my mind. And the image was, after I had recorded the video for the costume, I had reached down to gather stuff up to go back in my trunk, the tripod for my, you know, little phone and that sort of thing, the remote control to start the video and end the video, and I had reached up and grabbed my keys, and I almost threw them in the bag with the tripod, and I thought, no, those don't go in there, and so I had set them down. And I remembered that I thought to myself, no, those don't go there, but I also knew I was busy and I was bustling around, and I thought, I wonder if I put my keys back in that tripod bag. Sure enough, went out to the garage, got into the trunk where I would never think to look. And there they were, in the little tripod bag. Thank you, Jesus. So, Jesus talking. It's just amazing. It's just amazing. So, all is well. Got the new book started. I have a little breather right now between costumes, because we did April Fool's. Not last weekend, but the weekend before last. Got that done. That all went well. this weekend is International Moment of Laughter Day, so that'll be fun. Was going to be Unicorn Day. I have this 7 foot tall inflatable unicorn costume that I wear. It's very cute. And so that's what's happening in on Friday and Saturday. I have to find a buddy to eat with on Saturday, but I'll find somebody. And so I don't know what I was saying. Anyways, I need some food. So I have a little breather right now because the next big thing I'm working on is the National Nude Day, which is coming up on July the 14th. And so I'm actually ramping up to take the double din radio out of my car and put another thing in. So that's very exciting. So have a little breather there on costumes, but I am amassing the materials that I need to make the rhinestone cowboy nudie suit. So that'll be fun. That's coming in. So all is well. All is well. I'm always a bit reflective after the April Fool's stuff, because that's a really fascinating thing. For those of you who don't know, for 2 years running, and this will probably be it, at least until 2028, for 2 years running, April Fool's has fallen on either a Friday or a Saturday. And as part of that, I had this idea, would it be possible for me to play an April Fool's joke on people and go to the store without them knowing it was me when I was obviously dressed in a costume. So last year, I went as an aging Instagram influencer. Purple and pink hair, athletic wear, you know, real cute. It's fun. People laughed, they thought it was funny. Had multiple people that I just walked up right next to them and they did not know it was me. I have a video on YouTube called Phil Foolery, P-H-O-O-L-E-R-Y, Phil Foolery, from last year. And then, of course, this year we just did that again. Except this year I went as kind of the aging executive assistant, the long-suffering executive assistant with the really rich old geezer, which was my wife. That's a lot of fun. But the process of doing that's really fascinating. Because it's just so strange to slip off the makeup bench, you know, the makeup chair there, and look at yourself in the mirror, and you can tell it's you, but your features are all arranged, and people are treating you differently, and you know, there are certain societal overloads in all of that, especially now with the whole transgender movement and everything. And it's really interesting. And it causes me to think about a lot of things about this whole structure of male and female that we've built up. And I've talked about that multiple times. But I've been mulling on that again. And the unfairness, the unfairness of moving into that space for a guy to move into that space in any kind of serious way. Now, when I do it, people know it's just for a joke. And I got plenty of comments of, you know, wow, you have really nice legs. Well, thanks, you know. I mean, it's on the video that I did from this year, but I was at the soundboard at church, and one of my friends who's a beta reader came by, and she was grinning, and she had watched the video, and she said, I gotta say, you have really nice legs. I said, well, thanks. She said, yeah, this always bugs me. She said, it just bugs me. She said, I was at another place of work, and she said, you know, there was this person there that had really nice legs, too, and she said, I just kept thinking, man, you know, And then she said, I found out it was actually a guy. And then she said that kind of made it better a little bit. I said, yeah. But that whole thing, moving into that space of life on the other side of the gender divide and being able to live over there in a fairly high placement in the dominance hierarchy, because women form their dominance hierarchy in part, in large part, due to attraction. And it's just what is. And they will defer to others based on how attractive they believe another woman is. Just like guys will defer to other guys based on perceived strength, perceived handsomeness, etc., etc., perceived manliness, women will defer to other women in part based on the value that they perceive the woman has in the reproductive marketplace. So that's a very interesting thing when you kind of cross that divide. I'm getting my mail, one moment. You cross that divide, and you not only cross that divide, but you succeed in some ways. And as long as, you know, people all know it's a joke and that kind of thing, that you do get a lot of jokes about, wow, you're really pretty this, or you really better blah, 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 blah. But I try to make sure really quickly that everybody involved knows that this is just a joke, okay? It's just a joke, and we laugh and we carry on. And I'm not serious about this, and I certainly do my best not ever to come across as condescending when I'm in any of those situations, you know, or haughty or proud or anything. It's, I'm, you know, just make jokes and go on. But it's very interesting because it's, granted, I have some confidence as an individual to begin with because of everything I've been through. So there is a certain level of confidence that I enjoy as I move through life. And so I can be dressed up in crazy stuff and I can still project confidence. And in fact, I was in Walmart one day, and I think it was Mother's Day, so I'm in the flouncy little Lolita dress, and I've got my big lollipops and stuff, and I saw a guy that I actually know who was a higher up at one of the colleges and stuff, and I went, hey! And so we started talking to that kind of stuff, and I'm in this ridiculous little girl costume. I got the big bow in my hair and the whole bit. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's I got bloomers on. It's just ridiculous. And I'm just sitting there having a conversation with him like it's nothing. And he paused at one point and he said, you know, confidence is an amazing thing. And I grinned. I said, yes, it is. Yes, it is. You can pretty much navigate through all kinds of weird stuff if you're confident. And you can put people at ease and you can, you know. So when I transform into an April Fool's thing and it's a joke and everybody knows it's a joke, I still come across as very confident. And it's actually a little bit unfair because I don't carry the emotional load that a woman carries in her relationship with being attractive, because it's always kind of a double-edged sword for women. Most women. The double-edged sword is, yes, I want to be attractive, but I don't want it to attract the wrong sorts of people, and I don't want to have to think about all the time how hard I'm working to be attractive. And so it's this very unsettled brew of how attractive am I, or people see, do people see that I'm attracted? Oh, I'm worried that they don't. Oh, I'm worried that they do. There's not just a very comfortable inhabiting of their own skin. And one of the things that I was really happy with as Lizzie grew more and more mature as a young woman, and then as a married woman, and then she reported back to me that in fact, people would report to her and they would say, I don't know any woman who's as comfortable as you are in your skin, which is really good. That makes me very happy. So anyways, I came across this article and I've been thinking about the whole April Fool's thing and how interesting it is and that kind of thing. This, I think, was in Elle magazine, I think. The title of the article is There's Nothing Effortless About Being a Woman. And what guys often do is when they're on the outside of this looking in, their response typically is, well, if it's such an effort, why do you even do it? But they're missing the whole point. And that is the fact that this is all being driven by an anxiety that is somewhat quenched by all these rituals. And yet these rituals extract their own price in time and effort and pain. And because of that, there's this dissatisfaction with having to do this. And yet there's a benefit in terms of the anxiety relief in doing it. And so you're just in this churn all the time. And then I, as a guy, can just go down to Current Salon and flop down on a bench. And I'm not nervous about it because I have some confidence and I can get slathered with makeup and then go do the thing. And I got to tell you, it takes forever to get off. And I just can't imagine being pushed to that all the time. But I do understand that being pushed to it is a very real experience. And Amy Choi, in this article, you know, really... really does a good job of sort of illustrating this churn. And I bring this article up simply because for us as men, it's very easy for us to dismiss what kind of levels of anxiety must exist to cause people to go through this. And it would be wise of us as men not to dismiss or denigrate the anxiety with some kind of flippant comment like, well, if you hate it so much, why do you even do it? No, no, don't do that. The better comment is, wow, I'm just, wow. You know, I can just see that's effort. Sympathizing as opposed to trying to fix things. So anyways, I'll just read you a little of this. Some of this is a little, it's a little descriptive, but you know, hey, just to give you an idea of what some people are going through. So she says, twice a year I have a ritual. I go up to the 32nd Street in Manhattan's Koreatown and head into an anonymous building where I'm greeted by a tiny, beautiful Russian woman who leads me to a stack of mesh disposable undies, the likes of which I haven't seen since slipping on some of those bad boys in the maternity ward after giving birth. And then I'm directed into, I edited some of this out. I'm directed into an igloo-shaped hot dry sauna, then a hot tub full of lemons, and then a cold tub full of cucumbers, and then a hot wet sauna. The spa is not so much relaxing as it is a march of efficiency. She has other descriptions in here. Everything around me is busy. Small Asian women bustle about, directing customers here and there, guiding dripping, naked bodies to and fro. After emerging dripping sweat from the steam room, I am led by the elbow to my penultimate destination, a vinyl top massage table that recalls a combo of your great aunt's plastic covered floral love seat and Hannibal Lecter's dissection room. Here, my clinician instructs me to remove the mesh and to lay down on my belly. Then while she's there, there's more descriptions. Buckets of hot water from an industrial-sized drum are splashed on her. There's a pause as she straps on the tools of her trade, sandpapery gloves with which she will scour every inch of my body, etc., etc., etc. The whole thing takes an hour. I will shed at least 3 pounds worth of dead skin enduring countless buckets of hot water and be manipulated this way and that before on the plastic butcher block. This is before I get passed off to a sadist dressed as a facialist to extract 6 months worth of goo from the pores on my nose and chin and get layered up in algae and kelp. I pay extra for that and scolded for letting my face absorb so much filth. That's just the beginning. This is so I can then go to a multitude of beauty stores on 32nd Street and literally buy every snail smigba to smear on my face every night after washing my face twice with two different kinds of rice oils, etc. And she's talking about the fact that this beauty regimen, there's nothing effortless about it. So why does she do all this? She says the key is to be only imperfect enough to be charming so that I can say, oh, I don't really wear makeup. I'm pretty low maintenance, so I can be the kind of lady that is effortless. So, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, she goes on and all the things. You know, early on, it was very clear to me that there was a right way to have a perfectly messy ponytail and slightly disheveled t-shirt or lean, loungy body. Somewhere in the very narrowly defined gray area between outcast and edgy, nonchalant, and within acceptable standards of beauty was the effortlessness I wanted to achieve. She talks about growing up in the Midwest as a Korean young woman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she talks about how the fact that she's living a lie and she's so tired. She says, because, of course, I am relaxed about literally nothing. I am effortful about everything, which extends far and far beyond trying to be pretty. Wait, I was relaxed about potty training my kids? Maybe. No, my husband and I were just too overwhelmed with having two kids under 3 years old that we essentially forgot to potty train and they did it themselves. The truth is, we were drowning. If you're nearly killing yourself with effort in other areas, turns out not putting any effort and somehow getting a good result can turn into an actual effortlessness. But oh, the temptation to lie, to blithely say to other parents, don't worry so much about potty training. It'll just happen when it happens. We hardly had anything to do. It was so easy. The mental gymnastics, she says, what a waste of blankety-blank effort. How much more useful, how much more joyful, how much easier it is to actually be truthful, to celebrate our efforts, to communicate, to create communities around our desires and not live with the shame that the desire for effortlessness brings for women and for standards of beauty. Maybe all the effort that goes into being effortless could be used, I don't know, in loving ourselves and loving each other. How transformative being honest could be. The lie doesn't just exhaust me, it hurts us all. When we lie about the basic values of our culture, that women must be beautiful, and yet do everything in our power to adhere to that value, we kill ourselves to make ourselves feel vulnerable and lie about the labor women must put into in adhering to the unspoken value of our culture. We have to be effortless. We ensure that nothing will ever change. We can't change our culture when we lie about what our culture is. We can't accept ourselves until we stop pretending that we already do. And we can't value our work until we acknowledge that this is work. This, please imagine me gesturing expansively to the world, that existing in a body as a woman in this world is work. Nothing is effortless. Now then, that is the reality for women. And I do recognize that I, as a man who dresses up like a woman and managed to achieve some level of attractiveness as a woman, which shocks a lot of women. And once I achieve that level of attraction, it really is in some definitions, effortless for me because I don't put on my own makeup. I don't go to the spas. I don't do any of that stuff. I just get dressed up in a way that will hide all my imperfections and flaws. And I lay down on this bench and get my makeup done and then scrub it all off later. And then once I'm off, I'm laughing and carrying on. And I don't really care what I look like. I mean, even when my heels are twisting and I'm walking bow-legged and I'm walking, you know, there was a little twinge of, well, you're walking bow-legged. And then I thought, yes, I am. I don't care. Because I'm not under that emotional load. But I don't think any of that will actually ever change for women until we get to the root of it. And the root of it is this very necessary level of anxiety that exists for women because they are magic. Because they can bear children. Because that was needed for the human race to survive. But I do think, and I think my daughter has achieved a level of it, hopefully with some understanding, I do think it is possible for women to gain an understanding of the mechanisms that are actually happening and to find ways to assist with tamping down that anxiety so that they can be more comfortable in their skin and they can move through life calmer. But it's never going to happen if the focus is always outward that, oh, society needs to stop demanding of this because it's not really society that's demanding it. It is the flesh that is taking advantage of that natural anxiety and that need for concern. It is the flesh that is taking advantage of that and amplifying it and then making the necessities of attraction I've just lost my train of thought. It is the flesh that is taking that natural anxiety that was necessary around childbirth and raising of children and allocating resources and amplifying it up until it's an anxiety that paralyzes, an anxiety that stresses, and it's far beyond what it needs to be. And then, of course, the marketers are out there and they understand that too, so they're amplifying it. But just because the marketers are amplifying what the ideal look should be doesn't mean that we as individuals have to buy into that. And so I see articles like this as interesting and fascinating, but I also know that an article like this, women can all sit around and read this article and go, yeah, that's right, we need to do something about that. But nothing will ever change because this cannot be changed at a cultural level. It has to be changed at an individual level. And each woman for themselves has to be comfortable with who they are in Christ and come to an understanding of what the world is trying to do to them and what their flesh is trying to do to them and seek within Christ the strength to say, you know what, I am not loved for my appearance. I am loved because I am a child of God. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.